This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
To call the meeting to order and welcome everyone to meeting number 138, House of Commons Standing Committee of Canadian Heritage. So our study is the protection of freedom of expression pursuant to Standing Order 108-2 and the motion adopted by the committee on Wednesday, September 18th, 2024. The committee shall resume its study of the protection of freedom of expression.
The Standing Committee on Canadian Heritage has for the past month been conducting a study on protecting freedom of expression. The contours of the study aren't entirely clear. In fact, after I was invited to appear, I asked for some sense of what the committee was looking to address. There wasn't much detail, which has really left it open for witnesses to cover whatever issues they like. For example, on the day that I appeared, one witness focused on misinformation and argued that the solution was more funding for the CBC. I chose to focus my time on two issues: the expression implications of Canadian digital policy and the chilling effect of anti-Semitism. The two issues have really dominated my attention in recent months. Digital policy, including bills C-11, C-18, C-63, and S-210 for many years now, and the anti-Semitism issues have become an enormous concern in the aftermath of October 7th. I devote this episode to taking the listener into the hearing room and the wide range of questions that my opening statement sparked. We start with my five-minute opening statement.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Geist. I'm a law professor at the University of Ottawa, where I hold the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. I appear in a personal capacity representing only my own views. I'd like to start by emphasizing that freedom of expression is rightly and widely recognized as foundational to robust, accountable, inclusive democracy. That said, there's always a balance to be struck. I'm sure we would all agree that there are limits where expression is viewed as so harmful that it should be restricted or rendered unlawful. Obvious examples include child pornography, defamation, and terrorism-related offenses. The difficulty generally doesn't lie with those kinds of cases. I'd like to focus on two cases that are much tougher: digital policy and the challenge of when expression chills other expression. First, digital policy. Bills C-11, C-18, C-63, and S-210 all intersect with expression either directly or indirectly. The direct examples are C-63 and S-210. These bills by design have expression implications. C-63 identifies seven harms that are defined as a kind of content, but each is a form of expression. This expression can cause harm, revenge porn, inciting terror, or bullying, for example. While I have some enforcement concerns, I think the bill identifies real harms and at least in part seeks to establish a balance in addressing them. More problematic are the Criminal Code and Human Rights Act provisions that are overbroad, may weaponize the human rights system, and have a chilling effect. Bill S-210 is even more direct in limiting expression, as it literally provides for federal court blocking orders of lawful content, and it envisions Canadian internet providers to do the blocking. This is a dangerous bill that should go back to the drawing board. I think bills C-11 and C-18 both have indirect effects on expression. In the case of C-11, supporters were far too dismissive of the implications of regulating user content, with some going so far as to deny it was in the bill, only to later issue a policy direction that confirmed its presence. C-18 not only led to the blocking of news links, but it failed to recognize that linking to content is itself expression. The net effect has been to cause harm to news-related expression in Canada. We need to do better when it comes to digital policy, as we haven't always taken the protection of expression sufficiently seriously in the digital policy debate. Second, there is expression that chills other expression. This can occur where expression includes harassment or strikes fear in some communities, invariably leading to a chill in their ability to express themselves. My own community, the Jewish community, is a case in point, as the rise in anti-Semitism in a manner not seen in Canada in generations has sparked fear, safety fears, and chilled expression. No group has faced and been the target of more hate crimes than the Jewish community. On campuses, this manifests itself with students and faculty concealing their identity by hiding their religion, political beliefs, or fearing speaking out in class. I'm wearing a Bring the Hostages Home pin today, a form of expression, but many would be reluctant to do so on our streets and campuses. Encampments, graffiti, vandalism, doxing, online threats, the abandonment of institutional neutrality, and the exclusion of those who believe in Zionism from classes or parts of campus have become too commonplace and have had a corrosive effect on those targeted and undermined their expression rights. Universities, workplaces, and other communities have long recognized the harm of expression chilling other expression. It's why we have codes designed to ensure not just physical safety, but freedom from abusive or demeaning conduct that constitutes harassment and may limit the expression of others. In a committee focused on protecting freedom of expression, there are many things that can be done. Ensuring we have clearly defined policies, such as the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, active enforcement of campus policies and codes, principled implementation of institutional neutrality, and leadership in speaking out against conduct that creates fear and chills speech. In our broader communities, time and place restrictions, such as those included in the court ruling involving the encampment at the University of Toronto, preserve both the rights of those who want to protest and those for whom the encampment created real harms and chilled their expression. Similarly, bubble zone legislation to safeguard schools, community centers, and places of worship strikes a much-needed balance. This past year has served as a wake-up call for many. Taking action against hate enhances expression rather than detracting from it, and we must all do our part in this fight. Thank you for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Jamil Javani, a Conservative MP, was first up for questions. He asked me about digital policy and censorship.
Mr. Geist, thanks for being with us today. I'd like to ask you some questions about digital policy, in particular about some of the legislation that many Canadians have called Justin Trudeau's censorship agenda. Some of the legislation you referred to, C-11, C-18, for example. C-11 gets misrepresented by Liberals here in Ottawa very often as an attempt to push back on big businesses, big corporations, social media companies, you know, American influence. But you wisely pointed out that in a policy directive, they did make clear that included in Bill C-11 is a measure of regulating user-generated content. I'd like for you to elaborate on why that's significant and why Canadians should be concerned about that being included in a Liberal policy directive.
Well, this is deja vu all over again, as I had a chance to peer the committee on that bill. And, you know, I think the core of the bill, it does involve the notion of trying to bring large streaming services into the Canadian broadcasting framework. And we're seeing how some of that plays out before the CRTC now with, I think, some real concerns, frankly, about consumers ultimately paying the price on some of the increased costs. But with respect to the inclusion of user-generated content, the policy directive actually directs the CRTC not to regulate users. And the CRTC has followed that. But throughout the process, there were continual denials that this even existed in the legislation, when I think it was readily apparent to just about everybody that it did. And the concern there was that some of the powers that were vested in the regulator could have an impact on the expression rights of those creators, noting now that the policy direction says don't do this, but the legislation at least opened the door to things like elevating through algorithms certain content over other content. And what you had were many digital creators, Canadian digital creators, who made the case that they were finding success online and were deeply concerned that having a regulator step in and have an impact in terms of how their stuff would appear on some of these large platforms could have an impact on their livelihood and what Canadians are able to see.
So the fact that the legislation opened the door, to use your phrasing, for the federal government to regulate user-generated content, what is the significance of that in your view? And also, do you think that the concerns raised during the process about the possibility of that regulation over user-generated content were appropriately weighed in the process of putting this legislation forward?
Well, I should note that the legislation actually initially did not include this, include user content. It was during clause by clause of an earlier iteration of the bill that the bill was changed to remove an exception that had previously excluded it. I think the concerns were real. In fact, once the bill left this committee and left the House and went to the Senate conducted extensive hearings on that same bill and actually proposed an amendment to try to directly address that issue. I thought it was unfortunate that government or the House ultimately rejected that proposed amendment, sent it through as they did, and now have been forced, essentially, if they really do want to exclude user content, to put this in a policy direction. So for the moment, the policy direction rules. But a policy direction, of course, doesn't have the same kind of power that legislation does. And I think that's why many had raised this issue. Sometimes we're told there was really nothing to be concerned about, and yet the reality was it was quite clearly there. And there were easy fixes, quite frankly, that I think would have maintained the policy objectives that the government and other groups had, while at the same time ensuring that there were better safeguards about including user content within that within the scope of the law.
When Canadians see this pattern of legislation that's been put forward by the current government, I think that a lot of the time they're being gaslit by the Liberal government to not be concerned, to sort of downplay what are legitimate concerns about concentration of power in the hands of bureaucracies to control what Canadians can see and hear online and consequently what they can say online. When you see that those attempts to sort of say to Canadians, don't worry about it, like, don't even raise a red flag, like, trust the government, how do you respond to that phenomenon we're observing here in Ottawa?
Well, I suppose that at the end of the day, my concern here, and I mentioned it in my opening, was that I don't think we've taken the expression-related issues seriously enough as part of the digital policy. And I should be clear, this isn't just about C-11 and C-18. The opposition parties, unlike the government, has been supporting S-210, which raises real expression rights as well. So I'm not sure that anybody comes here with fully clean hands about addressing some of those kinds of issues. I wish that all parties would take more seriously some of these issues. And to your point about gaslighting, when there are voices, sometimes voices that aren't the typical people that appear before a committee raising these kinds of concerns, that those concerns are taken more seriously. Because I think there was a sense amongst many that that simply wasn't the case through the process in C-11.
Would you say that there is an appropriate amount of concern as you observe this legislation, any one of the four that you mentioned, as you see that legislation before, do you see an appropriate amount of concern over state overreach? Do you think that that's something that needs to be emphasized more?
I think we always need to be cognizant of what it means to have government intervene in this way. I think we are, as you heard in your earlier panel, increasingly appreciating the concern of overreach from platforms as well, and that's part of what we're trying to grapple with here. But in sometimes, as we venture into some of these newer spaces and these newer kinds of regulation, you often get new voices come forward as well. And there's at times been a bit of a reticence to include some of those kinds of perspectives as part of the discussion or perhaps even as part of the policy development.
Could you be more specific in terms of the perspectives?
He can, but another round.
Okay.
I didn't have the chance to name the groups later, but would have included groups like Digital First Canada and entities like Village Media. Now, later in the same hearing, Damien Couric, another Conservative MP, returned to the same issues around digital policy and censorship.
One of the witnesses suggested that if Canadians couldn't view their news online, they should simply go to the library. And it certainly sounded a little bit like a let-them-eat-cake moment when it comes to the ability for Canadians to access content. And in a world in which, whether it's the devices we carry or the computers that we use, there's been a democratization of information that I think has been quite extraordinary, probably in the history of the world, although I think you can look back at different points in time and see other innovations. But certainly I hear from constituents all the time that are incredibly concerned about government overreach and wanting to control certain aspects of what that looks like, whether it's direct or whether it's indirect. Mr. Geist, in terms of Bill C-11 and C-18, you have one that has had a massive impact on Canadians' ability to see news content. And I've heard from many companies that would suggest that they just want to be able to share their content on those platforms and able to continue to get their content in front of the eyes of Canadians. And then you have C11 that is kind of like this backdoor censorship idea that there's a mechanism for control within the bureaucracy. I'm wondering if you could comment specifically on those two pieces of legislation and the chilling effect that that has on freedom of speech and freedom of expression across this country.
Talked a little bit earlier about C-11, so let me focus for a moment on C-18. C-18 was predicted, and it was predictable, quite frankly, that if the legislation was introduced as is, it would cause a number of potential concerns. There was a likelihood that we would see blocking of news links, which is what's happened. It was likely that it would undermine trust, because if you find that there is more and more government regulation and government funding, I think it does run the risk of funding. Now, of diminishing trust. Now, with all due respect to my co-panelists here, the notion that we can solve all of this simply by more money to the CBC, or suggesting, with all due respect, that somehow Post Media owns 80% of newspapers and that's the problem, and at the same time note that now everybody has the ability to speak out, there are a lot of different sources, and if we only think about individual media properties as somehow having a monopoly on the news, then we're missing what is actually taking place right now, which is that there is a wide range of different sources. And one of the real harms that occurred with respect to C-18 was that it oftentimes excluded some of the more innovative players in the marketplace, and with a broad brush, had the effect of excluding all of those players from major platforms like Instagram and Facebook.
So going to the library certainly isn't a solution. When it comes to C-11, the added bureaucracy and the CRTC, and I know you've written quite extensively about that, and how that level of control certainly is problematic in terms of Canadians being able to see that content, which there's this close connection between C-11 and C-18, which I know quite often the government doesn't like to see that connection made. But I'm wondering if you could comment on the C-11 side and simply Canadians being able to, while not be able to post content, the ability that it's limited in terms of what they can see.
C-11 hasn't stopped anybody from seeing anything online. The concern was on the algorithmic side as to whether or not, on the user from a user content perspective, some content would be prioritized or deprioritized. Now, the CRTC just last week has launched new consultation that will focus on the meaning of Canadian content. We will see what it does with respect to discoverability, so it may prioritize some content over other content, and we may see that play out on some of these larger services. It isn't in the game of blocking particular content, though. There's nothing in C-11 that would move towards blocking of particular content.
Just in conclusion, has C-11 and C-18 had a chilling effect on innovation in Canada's mediascape?
Well, I think certainly, I think the answer to that would be yes, or at least from an investment perspective. When we look at C-11, the way the CRTC has begun to implement that law with basic mandated contributions, we've already seen increased prices for consumers. And we've seen some players that may look at the Canadian market and feel that the regulatory costs are too high. On C-18, I think it's even more significant, though, because if you lose one of your major distributors of your content, if there are no more links to your content through some of these larger platforms, this sends a signal that this is not a marketplace to invest in. And we've seen some of the larger independent players, Village Media, for example, stopped entering into new Canadian markets for a period of time out of concern. And the message that it sends to others who might want to enter into the marketplace by providing new innovative news services is that this is a market where there are some of the regulations may inhibit the ability to have success in the marketplace.
Meanwhile, Bloc MP Martin Champoux asked me about Bill C-63, the online harms bill.
Professor Geist, you piqued my curiosity when you referred to C-63. I think we would really enjoy a discussion on that bill because I think it contains good things, but there are also aspects of it that might be looked into. So, but I was surprised about your comments about the bill. So should we just scrap it altogether? Should it go back to the drawing board? But in C-63, there's something that's striking for me. There is a section that allows people to report others on the sole suspicion that they could be about to say something hateful or do something. What do you think is the element that led to the insertion of a section of that caliber in that bill?
Okay. Thanks for that. First, I want to preface by making clear when I said legislation needs to be going back to the drawing board. I was actually referring to Bill S-210, which is the age verification bill that includes the blocking that I referred to and a number of other issues. C-63 needs to go to committee. And I think that it's really in some ways two bills in one. There is the element that is the larger part of online harms, which deals specifically with the responsibility of the internet platforms. And I think there's a lot that can be worked with there. I have some concerns about the enforcement mechanisms that have been established, but I think there's a lot that's there. What you are referring to, though, is the criminal code provisions. Mm-hmm. And in particular, an attempt to create essentially the equivalent of a peace bond for speech in this context. Now, we use these kinds of things in other contexts, right? If we're concerned about domestic violence, we might, and it's imminent, we might get an order to ensure that that doesn't happen or try to prevent that from taking place. This would be similarly an attempt to prevent certain kinds of potentially hate from taking place. If, you know, as I mentioned off the top, Jewish community has seen an unprecedented number of shootings and targets at synagogues and at schools. If we had knew that that was coming, then a bond might be able to try to stop some of those kinds of activities from taking place. I think, though, and Professor Laidlaw mentioned this before, both the Criminal Code and the Human Rights Act provisions that are in the legislation run the risk of overreach, and frankly, the bill should be split, and we should be focusing on the internet stuff and leave this other stuff for a separate study.
Toward the end of the hearing, Liberal MP Talib Noor Mohammed raised Bill S-210, as well as foreign ownership-related issues.
Professor Geist, let me start with you. You talked about Bill S-210 and the concerns around that. I share your concerns. I think it is a deeply flawed piece of legislation with some good intention. I think that is clear. But I think that the execution on this is, if rolled out the way the bill proposes, could actually be quite problematic. Very briefly, if you could summarize your concern around the enforcement of this, particularly as it relates to the private sector having to being in a position to hold data and in particular to determine age verification. What are some of the concerns around that you would have?
Well, I'm glad you raised it. There are several major concerns with S-210. I mentioned some in the opening with respect to mandated blocking of content and getting internet providers to block that as well. I think that raises serious issues. The use of age verification technologies. We've seen privacy commissioners around the world raise real concerns about this issue. I must admit, I find it both problematic and deeply puzzling that we would rush ahead with a piece of legislation when our own privacy commissioner is still studying the implications of using age verification technologies. And what we know is that where the technology is at right now either requires the provision of highly sensitive personal information, uploading to services outside the country by and large, identification documents that are government issued, which raises issues around identity theft, or it's based on technology that tries to guesstimate your age, which simply doesn't work in legislation that is designed to distinguish between someone who is 17 and 18. Just go into any high school or first year university class and try to determine who's 17, who's 18, and who's 19. If we can't do it as individuals, are we really going to trust some sort of algorithm to make that determination?
So just on that point, just very quickly, because to speak to those that may support this bill, there are those who have supported this bill and think it's a very, very good piece of legislation. Many of our conservative colleagues have said they support this, but, you know, at the same time also decry the idea of digital ID. I mean, how do you reconcile those two thoughts? If you're against digital ID, but you support digital identification, verification, age verification held by the private sector, what would you say to them to kind of clear up that misunderstanding?
Well, I think it's line drawing between saying the government is going to issue an ID and I'm going to provide my actual ID to some third party that I may have even less trust in as part of this system. I think the risks from a security and privacy perspective are very real, but especially if we're having a discussion around freedom of expression, the site blocking, the overbroad use of this. This would apply not just to pornography sites. This would apply to search sites, would apply to streaming sites. It's hard to reconcile saying there's deep concern about stopping acts of about censorship and freedom of expression when we're considering legislation that would actually, in an overbroad way, require some sort of pre-approval to be able to conduct a Google search or watch some streaming services on something like Crave or Netflix.
So your advice to members of the Conservative Party and others who support this legislation would be that they should not?
My understanding is it's been all the opposition parties that at least previously voted for it, and I think it's a mistake, and it needs to go back to the drawing board.
Thank you. I want to take a bit of a different line of questioning now with the 2 minutes I think that I have left. My colleague, Mr. Desjardins, started asking questions about foreign ownership of the media and some of the challenges and concerns there. When Post Media was taken over by a U.S. hedge fund, they were told to be, quote unquote, more reliably conservative. Do you see, you talked about earlier, if there are other voices that need to be amplified, you need to be heard. Are you concerned at all that foreign ownership and foreign direction of where Canadian journalism or media should go has the same chilling impact when there is not the ability for a counterbalance for other voices to emerge within the ecosystem?
I think there's reason for concern with foreign interference. I must admit, especially in some of the regulated sectors, I've never totally understood some of the objections to foreign ownership. You know, broadcasters, for example, doesn't really matter who owns it. What matters is what rules are associated with it. In an internet environment, I recognize clearly when you've got large foreign players, there's more risk. Candidly, that fact means we'd want to bring some of those players in, which makes the recent TikTok decision a bit puzzling, because I don't understand why we'd kick out a company that makes it more difficult to enforce against it where we've got some of those kinds of issues. So I think we need to seek to ensure there is a role for regulation of these large players. Part of it is ensuring that they do operate here and we've got appropriate rules in place.
The anti-Semitism issues garnered attention as well. Liberal MP Anna Ganey asked about the bubble zone legislation that I'd referenced in my opening statement.
Mr. Geist, I'm kind of curious if we could for a second go back to some of your opening remarks regarding, I guess, hate speech and by extension, the conversation around bubble legislation. This is something that I'm hearing quite a lot about in my community, touching on some of the things you spoke about. There's obviously some tension there again with civil liberties that are a part of that discussion. And I think my colleague and maybe one of the witnesses also discussed, you know, the balance of expression with equality and safety. So I'm wondering if you could maybe expand a little bit on that piece of your opening remarks in terms of this discussion and the role of the federal government specifically in protecting freedom of expression and freedom of protest with the balance of safety and I guess equality as well.
Raising that. At the end of this, we're scheduled to end around 2 o'clock. And over the course of the weekend, there were plans to launch a protest at what for a long time was my kid's school, Sir Robert Borden, here in Ottawa. And that was called off. They're instead going to apparently protest an MPP. But the notion of potentially protesting while kids are in school, as young as 12 years old, raises, I think, significant concerns. We've seen it at community centers. And so we have seen cities for on a number of issues, not just with respect to anti-Semitism, which, as I note, has been by far the largest target in terms of hate crime in Canada over the last couple of years, and especially since October 7th. But I know Mississauga is also considering this, and they're considering not out of that issue, but out of other community members where we've seen tensions and some of this protest. I think that alongside similarly the decision that we saw coming out of the encampments at the University of Toronto seeks to have the balance, the same way Professor earlier mentioned, that we've got to find a way to allow people to protest, but where that endangers others, where that creates genuine fear that limits their own expression rights and even limits their own safety, that it is, I think, inappropriate, whereas we heard earlier that there is often a need to strike a balance. How do we ensure that people enjoy those protest rights, but at the same time, others feel safe in their communities, in their places of worship, and in their schools? And bubble zone legislation allows for those protests to continue, but ensures the safety of many others. And I think that's been sorely lacking in many communities for the last number of months across the country.
There's certainly a sentiment of that feeling of insecurity and a lack of safety in particular around those places of worship and schools, as you mentioned, which has been very, very, very troubling to see over the last year. I guess if we could go back a second to the conversation around censorship as well, which has come up a few times here. I'm wondering if you could perhaps clarify, you know, in the spirit of the freedom of expression, you know, part of how we get to these tense situations, I think, is a misunderstanding or a misalignment or a lack of truth or common understanding of what things mean and what is true. And we have that, I think, behind some of the misunderstandings around some of the protests and the content and the hate speech or the language that's being used there. So if we're free to say what we want and to create these environments where people just don't understand each other and don't have the same starting point, you know, how do we clarify that, you know, in my view, there is not censorship through the Online News Act, and that we shouldn't be fueling that notion that that's what that is, and that maybe that doesn't contribute to the real conversations that we should be having about how to legislate and how to improve people's safety and how to protect kids online and how to keep people safe. How do we find common ground to have these conversations if we can't agree on what things like censorship are?
Yeah, well, listen, it's been a significant challenge. It's a significant challenge quite clearly. I think in some ways, I've tended not to use the word censorship when it comes to this legislation, even though I do think some of the bills that we've been talking about do raise real concerns. I think in terms of the kind of common understanding, and I think you heard it earlier, there is a difference between misinformation and disinformation. And on the misinformation side, I think there is a lot of misinformation, but I think a lot of that does go part and parcel with freedom of expression. And it isn't an intent to deceive. It merely some people aren't accurate or they're misinformed. That is distinct from disinformation, where someone, I think, has the, at times, intent to misinform and create potential some real harm through that disinformation. And on that front, whether or not we need the government to step in, but or more likely, I think, in some instances, because I think there are risks and there are charter limitations on what government can do. But more likely, there is a role to play for, I think, some of the large platforms. We've seen over the last week or two this mass move towards blue sky for a lot of former Twitter users or X users. And I think part of that reflects the fact there are a lot of people who are frustrated with an environment where anything goes, there is this misinformation and disinformation, and they're looking for a place that they feel is a bit more trustworthy. So in some ways, the market actually addresses at least some of those issues, so long as there are some of those alternatives available.
Finally, Shampoo also focused on anti-Semitism and hate-related concerns, referencing a block bill that would remove a religious exemption found in our hate speech laws.
Professor Geist, I have another question for you. My party, the Bloc Québécois, tabled a bill that suggests, well, it came after a protest where Adil Sharkawi had very violent remarks, inciting people to violence, calling for the elimination of Canada and the United States, but also Israel. So in the aftermath of all this, we proposed a modification to the criminal code to remove the criminal, the religious exception from the criminal code, because this religious exception allows an individual who is uttering remarks under the guise of their religious beliefs to say things that would go beyond what's reasonable. So this bill, would it encroach upon the freedom of expression or the freedom of religion according to the reading of things that you have done, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the Criminal Code?
Well, you know, thanks for that. I think the answer is yes, it would. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a non-starter. And as we've heard, there is a balancing act to be had when it comes to all of the rights. And in a sense, that's built in into our charter. I mean, we heard earlier that that is a hallmark of the Canadian approach, that these rights aren't absolute and there is a need to balance. And so balancing freedom of religion, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, some of the other and association, some of those other rights are always going to be a challenge. And where there may be people who use some of these rights to engage in conduct that quite clearly is not just harmful in terms of what's being said, but has had real-world impact in terms of the safety of kids going to school or people going to their synagogues. There is a need to act. We've seen some of that. We saw that, for example, with Samudan fairly recently, which was also some of their people involved in some of these kinds of protests. But after more than a year of these experiences and this massive increase in targeting communities, in my case, particularly the Jewish community, there is a need to act.
Do you think that this article of the criminal code, this exception, should it have even existed in the first place? And people feel a bit more free to express these kinds of opinions? I mean, maybe this is what is leading us to make the changes we talked about.
Yeah, no, I don't know the history of the inclusion of that particular provision, but I suspect it was based on a vision of a robust protection for freedom of religion and a recognition that there was potential risks of a chill in terms of that ability to practice if we were seen to criminalize certain kinds of speech. But at the same time, if that is used as a safeguard or as a mechanism to get to engage in hateful conduct, then surely we have to consider how to address that kind of conduct, that religion doesn't provide a sort of a blank to allow people to say anything, especially when it creates some of these kinds of harms.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod or Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca. Or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.